Today is the 11th of June 2023. It is around 4:30 in the morning. I am recording this much earlier than I anticipated. I was supposed to record this much later in the day, but I haven't been able to sleep because 2 hours ago I was woken up by an earthquake. A freaking earthquake. Hey! The world right now feels profoundly chaotic. It feels loud. Right now, it feels like something is going to break. It feels like we are hurtling towards some kind of collapse. We've just come out of a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, and on the news, it seems as though we are on the brink of World War III. The financial markets are on the edge of an abyss, and locally, our economy is on life support and we barely have electricity. Through all of this, we are still trying to find a way to live spiritually meaningful lives. In the midst of rushing home before load shedding or dealing with the debilitating impact of unemployment, we are still trying to find ways to learn about who we are on a spiritual level and what our relationship is with God. And we are still trying to learn all the confusing information about ancestors and ukuphahla and who has a calling and what does this dream mean and what does that color candle mean and all of those things. All the while, we can barely sleep because we fear that the world will collapse around us and bury us in our own misery. Most people suffer from some kind of anxiety. A lot of people are dealing with depression, and this is around the world, really. So then the question is, how do you navigate spirituality in a world falling apart? The answer to this question, for me, will depend on how you answer this particular question. Spiritually, what do you believe about yourself? It's not about what you believe about your ancestors or your guides or Jesus or God or whatever else, but what do you believe about you? I believe that this answer will determine a lot about how you navigate your life during this period of chaos. And at a fundamental level, this is the most important question that you can ask yourself right now. In order to get to this answer, we need to go through a bit of a process, and we are going to need to take a trip into time. I want to start by confessing that I have a fascination with timescales. And specifically, I am fascinated by the 200-year timescale. What I mean by this is that I spent a lot of time wondering what the world will be like in 200 years' time. I think that 200 years is enough for a lot of things to change in our world, but not that long that it is a world that is totally alien to us, and there's still some things that we can still relate to in that time. But Obviously, for now, any thoughts on the year 2022-23 are pure speculation. With that said though, 2023 is 200 years after 1823. And since, because of historical records, we can actually have a good picture of how the world has changed or not since that time. When you try to read up on the history of anything to do with Africa, you will quickly realize that you can't always trust what it is that you're reading or hearing. The further back you go, the more biased and fragmented the information becomes. Most historical accounts of Africans and Africa, or indigenous people anywhere really, were written by colonizers who had much to gain from the information being portrayed in a specific kind of way. Because of this, I spent a lot of time trying to find books that were written by Africans themselves, and not African scholars who scour the history books to try to piece together what possibly could have happened or what could be true. I mean, books written by people who lived in the time that they were writing about. People who had first-hand experience of those historical times. This research has led me to two books. One of them is titled Black People and Whence They Came by Magema Magwaza Fuze. Ubab Fuze was born in 1844 in the area that we now call KwaZulu-Natal. The title is actually an English translation of the first publication that he put out called Abantu Abamnyama Lapha Bevela Ngakhona. This book was released in 1922. It is considered to have been the very first book written in isiZulu by a Zulu author. I basically had to get both the Zulu and English versions of this book together because although I understand isiZulu and I can read some of it, it is not really a language that I'm fluent in, and the English version has some things that get lost in translation, so I kind of had to read both of them simultaneously. The book is more of a personal journal than a historical document. I say this because I want to make it clear that his accounts are from his personal perspective and not necessarily the output of some vigorous academic process. He shares his views and understanding of history and the life lived during his lifetime. And despite the title, he only ever vaguely touches on the actual origins of black people by briefly mentioning that the elders simply point northwards, implying that we come from further up on the African continent towards a point that he says is the Suez Canal, which is essentially Egypt. The book details the early encounters between Africans and Europeans and the impact that this had on social and cultural lives of the people at the time. It delves into a lot more detail about a number of Zulu clans and lineages, and I think a Zulu person or a person of Zulu ancestry would find it interesting how a person who lived in the 1800s understood aspects of their culture and history. What I found fascinating was some of his accounts of daily life. There's a hilarious comparison that he makes between who he calls the Nguni people and the Ntungwa. He says that the biggest difference between the Ntungwa and the Nguni is that the Ntungwa are afraid of being naked. While the Nguni have no shame in just having the bare minimum skins covering their private parts, he reckons that the Ntungwa's fear of seeing a person's nakedness was a contributing factor to their downfall as a people. He touches on race relations where he believes that interracial births will eventually lead to the eradication of black people because children born between a white man and a black woman never ever came out looking black. He was convinced that eventually all people will be white because the white man has a ferocious appetite to have sex with black women and impregnate as many of them as possible. It is interesting that in his time, the idea of a black man sleeping with a white woman was unheard of. He details some changes in cultural practices like how Shaka ended male circumcision. The iconic Zulu leader opted to instead conscript young men into his military regiment as a way of initiating them into manhood, thus raising a generation of somewhat Spartan warriors rather than just grown men. The reason that I found this interesting is because we as Africans tend to believe that cultural practices are things that are either set in stone or can only change by themselves over a prolonged period of natural evolution. The idea that a leader can consciously and deliberately institute changes in a cultural practice is something that seems to many of us as taboo. In the earlier chapters of the book, Ubabfuze talks about the Khoi, whom he called by the derogatory term of the time, Hottentots. There's also a part where he maps out how the Khoisan language influenced the Xhosa language, with an example of how in the Khoisan cosmology, the word for God is Tiko, and through interactions between the two groups, Xhosa people ended up adopting the word to refer to their God as Tiko as well. He talks about how alcohol was their ultimate undoing. The alcohol that he is referring to was a type of fermented concoction called grog or chroch. Upon reaching the Cape, he says, they became slaves to the Boers, having been led to excessive drinking. In the end, they forgot their own language and took the language of the Boers only. In the end, the owners of the land became the subjects of the white people with nowhere to live because of their addiction to alcohol. He echoes a stern warning when he says, "You people, beware of alcohol because it is a serpent that bites." Chiefs who drink and elders as well who owned large herds no longer possess cattle kraals because of drinking. As I said before, the factuality of his accounts is murky at best, but this is how he viewed the reality of his time. Another book that I got was a compilation called Imbali Zamandulo, Stories from the Past. This is a selection of historical testimonies produced by Xhosa-speaking residents of the now Eastern Cape between 1838 and 1910. These narratives offer insights into the history of the Xhosa-speaking peoples, providing their own perspective on their own past. The nice thing about this book is that it is written in both isiXhosa and in English, and it allows you, if you can read isiXhosa, to get some of the more nuanced aspect of the language. One of the entries in the book was an entry titled Isizathu Zokuxhelwa Kwenkomo NgoNongqawuse, or Motivation of the NongQawuse Cattle Killings. This entry is dated as the year 1888 by William Wellington Qoba. He was born in August 1840, and in his relatively short life, he died when he was 48, he had become a well-renowned Xhosa poet, a translator and a journalist, as well as the editor of Isigidimi Zamaxhosa, the Xhosa Messenger, a publication in which he also published his own articles on the history of the Xhosa people. In this entry, Qoba gives his own account of the infamous story of uNongqawuse and the cattle killing movement in the Eastern Cape in 1856. This entry was intriguing for me because it was made 32 years after the actual incident. In fact, he and uNongqawuse were alive at the same time and lived in relative close geographic proximity to each other. This is not to say that this makes his reporting of the story more factual, but in a temporal and geographic scale, he is far closer to the truth than I will ever be. The story of uNongqawuse is quite common in South Africa, especially amongst amaXhosa. It is a story that takes on a mythical tone of cautionary tales, like the story of Pandora's box. But in reality, it is a very real story that is quite tragic and extremely haunting, and it represents one of the darkest moments in the history of amaXhosa and this country. The most common version of the story goes something like this. On a certain morning in 1856, a then 15-year-old uNongqawuse and another girl called uNombanda who was around 10 at the time, were in Nongqawuse's uncle's crop fields to chase away birds and to guard the crops. While they were there, two strangers appeared to Nongqawuse. It is said that these two strangers were in the form of ancestral spirits. The two beings, upon appearing, then gave Nongqawuse a message, a set of instructions that she was to pass on to the people of the local villages. The message and the instructions were as follows. There will come a time when the ancestors will rise again. For this to happen, all of the cattle in the land would have to be slaughtered. The cultivation of the crops was to stop. New pits for the storage of grains were to be dug up, and new houses had to be built. New cattle enclosures would have to be erected, and new milk sacks would have to be made. New doors would have to be woven. And the people needed to abandon witchcraft practices, incest, and adultery. The story goes that after 8 days, all the ancestors would rise again from the dead and will bring with them massive herds of cows and livestock, and the land would produce a bountiful harvest. With the help of her uncle, a certain Mhlakaza, the people were eventually convinced about Nongqawuse's prophetic vision and did as instructed. After the foretold 8 days came and went without incident, a devastating famine descended on the land. Many people starved to death, which allowed for a colonizing army to subdue a weakened Xhosa clan whose spirit had been scattered to the winds. The story, as it is commonly told, portrays Nongqawuse as a naive girl who was possibly misled. Popular interpretations today imagine that those two beings who appeared to her were most probably two white men dressed in some kind of costume and entrapped the girl who, according to this theory, may not have been familiar with white people. There are folk poems written about Nongqawuse as the person who led the Xhosa people to their demise. Very little is known about the little girl, whose only image exists as a black and white portrait in which she is dressed in ill-fitting layers of cloth and a lopsided headscarf with a despondent and vacant gaze. She was an orphan who lost both her parents at a young age to the wars and was raised by her uncle, who himself was a kind of a spiritualist. The account written by Utatu Qoba shares a very crucial part of the story that I personally had not seen or heard anywhere else. But before I share this version with you, I want to set the stage for what he says in order to understand just how profoundly important his version is. Nearly all of the songs and poems blame Nongqawuse for the disaster that fell upon her people. General estimates are around several hundreds of thousands of cattle were slaughtered during this period. Now, think about this for a moment. A 15-year-old orphaned girl convinced a nation made up of a number of clans and tribes headed by seemingly wise and battle-worn chiefs that they should perform an act that could potentially devastate the entire population, all in the belief that their ancestors would rise again and bring with them newfound wealth. A 15-year-old girl did this. A 15-year-old girl brought down an entire nation based off of one prophetic vision. This premise can only leave you with one logical question. How? The theory that comes up here is that her uncle, Mhlakaza, was able to confirm Nongqawuse's visions when he recognized in her description of one of the strangers that it was indeed one of his ancestors. But Mhlakaza was not necessarily a person of great stature. At best, he was the son of a counselor of the king at the time, and he himself became a counselor to the son of the king. But overall, he had no collateral to offer should a cat choke on a potato. There's nothing in the many versions that would convince us how Nonqawuse's prophecy alone brought on what was essentially a self-inflicted genocide. And this is where Utatgoba's version comes in for me. In his account, here's what he says actually happened. The story goes off like all the others, with the two girls in the field chasing off birds and the two strangers appearing. The same instructions are entrusted to Nonqawuse and she relays them to the elders. But no one believes her and nothing really happens. In fact, her uncle went to the fields himself to see the strangers for himself and, as you can imagine, they never appeared. Until one day, on the same field, the two strangers appeared again to the little girl and asked her if she had done what they had told her to do. She told them that she tried to, but no one believed her. The strangers then gave a final instruction. If the people needed to be convinced, then all the chiefs of the area must be summoned and must assemble at a certain point. Only then will the two strangers appear to everyone. The message was received by the son of Hinza, the king. He felt moved enough to dispatch the chiefs to, at the very least, see what would happen. And this is where the story takes a drastic detour. Cue the dramatic movie music. Nonqawuse led the delegation of chiefs to the mouth of the Tlaga River, where it opened into the Indian Ocean. They were extremely apprehensive, these great men being led by an orphan girl whose skin was covered in ochre. It was an exhausting trip, and as they neared their destination, one man asked if they could stop for a drink of water. In a disarming response, Nonqawuse said, "Those who had no spiritual enchantment on them can drink water." As such, only the tribe of Unomagwai stooped down and one by one drank from the river. It was at this point that giant boulders were heard rumbling down the cliffs of the Kamanga. The chiefs and their attendants were gripped by an all-encompassing sense of fear that the mountain would descend on them and swallow them whole. Then Nonqawuse said to them, "Cast your eyes upon the sea." When they gazed intently at the ocean waves, they seemed to see actual people. It was an army of people, the ancestors, with bulls bellowing and oxen, and a shadowy black mass that constantly went backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and until it departed again and disappeared under the towering ocean waves. In that vision, the ancestors spoke again, but only Nonqawuse could hear them. They repeated the same instructions which she told to the chiefs. After that moment, everyone began to believe. This is Utatgoba's version of what happened. Is it true? I don't know. Even with the supernatural moment, it makes more sense than the popular street version of the story. Something profoundly supernatural needed to have happened for so many chiefs to risk the lives of their own people. Something profoundly supernatural had to happen for this act and this movement to begin. This profound supernatural occurrence could not have been Nonqawuse's vision alone. It goes without saying that had the prophecy come true, you would have known who those chiefs were. They would have usurped the story and cast themselves as heroes. Nonqawuse would have been a minor character, a footnote at best. In this version of the story, however, Nonqawuse did not convince the chiefs. They saw the vision for themselves. But when things went wrong, it was the little orphan girl who took all the blame. And what exactly are they blaming her for? Well, when the eighth day came and went, and the hunger set in, those with youth and strength left saying that they were going to see if maybe the prophecy had come to pass. somewhere else. Maybe the miracle had occurred, just not here. Those who did not have the strength stayed. Dying mothers cradled the carcasses of their infants in their emaciated arms. There were elderly women from Unkwangu who leaned on their walking sticks and went in the direction of the mission stations. They left, but they never arrived. This is what a 15-year-old orphan girl is being blamed for. No one knows what became of Unongqawuse. The only information available is that in 1858, she was taken to a place called Pauper's Lodge in Cape Town as a prisoner. In 1859, a year after she arrived, Pauper's Lodge was broken down and her name was not even on the list of prisoners. She simply disappeared under the undulating waves of a distorted history. The simplified version of the tale of Unongqawuse gives the impression that everyone in the community was in agreement with what her prophecy had instructed. This was far from the truth. Not everyone participated in the slaughter of the cattle or the decimation of the crops. In reality, the community was split into two camps. There were those who believed Unongqawuse and went along with the instructions, and they were called Amathamba. Then there were those who did not buy into the whole thing, and they were called Amakokoja, which basically means to resist. They carried on tending to their livestock and tilling their fields. And even on the fateful day that was supposed to have been the day of resurrection, when the Amathamba were locked in their own homes, peeping through gaps through their new woven doors, hoping to catch a sight of the blood-red sky, Amakokoja were simply carrying on with their lives like any other day. The different stances that each group would take are pretty obvious, even to us in this day and age. But it is in how the two different groups contributed to how the story was shaped that is important to understand. When the written versions of the incident began to surface, the story of what happened, and more specifically why it happened, took on a completely different form. It is this very distortion that Utatgoba was trying to correct with his entry. His anger is quite palpable in his writing, specifically in how this story was being retold in the media of the time. According to some newspaper articles and books that were circulating at the time, the entire cattle killing was a ruse to whip up anger against white people. The theory was that once the prophecy did not come to pass, the people's anger would reach fever pitch and would compel them to turn their anger towards the colonizers and drive them into the ocean. Apparently, the cattle killing movement was an attempt to start a war with the white people. According to Utatukoba, it was the Amakokoja who helped to substantiate this claim as a way of ingratiating themselves to the white elite. His reasoning was that when the starvation set in amongst the Amathamba, the only people who had food were Amakokoja. Groups of marauding thieves began to target Amakokoja and in order to steal cows and raid their grain stores. In an attempt to gain the favor and protection of the white powers, Amakokoja began to support the claim that the prophecy was a plot to raise violence against the whites, which they, Amakokoja, had refused to be a part of. Utatgoba rubbishes the claims of the rules of war with a simple question. Why would a people slaughter their own livestock and destroy their own crops and build new houses, all in an attempt to start a war? When you read up on the story of Unongqawuse, you will come across another name that is less known, but one that is still crucial to the story of this episode, and that is Unontetha Nkwenkwe. She would grow up to be one of the most powerful and the most tragic female spiritual figures in Xhosa history. Umamnontetha was born in 1875. She was also born in what is today called the Eastern Cape. The world that she grew up in had been preceded by nearly a century of wars, and the European colonizers had all but conquered the Xhosa nation and taken most of the best arable land for themselves. This forced many able-bodied black people, mostly men, to leave the land of their births and to head to the cities to look for employment. Nontetha's husband, Upungu, was one of those people. He left their village of Kulile and died on the journey, leaving her a widow of 10 children, 5 of whom would die in their young ages. In the early 1900s, due to the spread of the mission schools, a divide had developed between amaXhosa, who had received an education, who were called amaXoboka, and those who had not attended the mission schools, who were subsequently illiterate, and they were called amaXaba, or abantu ababomvu, the red people, since they still adhered to using red clay as a kind of body lotion which gave their skin a red tint. The Christianized Africans embraced Western clothing and Western culture and the English language. They could also participate in the cash economy of the Europeans. Those known as the red people, abantu ababomvu bona, valued their traditional dress, language and cultural practices and actively resisted participating in the cash economy. Umam Nontetha at the time had a reputation as a herbalist, a xhwele, and as a seer. Her legend begins to take shape when in 1918 the Spanish flu, a strain of the influenza virus that had killed nearly 40 million people around the world, reached South Africa and is estimated to have killed over 30,000 people in the Eastern Cape alone. The deaths came as such a shock to the community that routine activities ground to a halt as the sick and the healthy wrestled with the disease. Household chores were neglected, cattle were left straying in the fields, and untended crops withered. One missionary reported that he saw the dead lying in the same hut as the living, who are themselves too weak and too indifferent with pain to try to move the dead. Umam Nontetha herself caught the flu, but managed to overcome it. One day, while she was walking from a friend's house, she was carrying a door that she was going to use in her home. Like women in the rural areas do when they have to carry a heavy load, she was carrying it on her head. Earlier in the day, she had been preparing to brew traditional beer that she would sell later on. This was essentially her business. This is how she made money. During the walk, she felt a sharp pain in her back and had to bend over until she felt like her back was going to break. Eventually, she got home and put down the door, and immediately she was overcome by an illness. This illness brought on expansive dreams in which she was shown many visions. According to these visions, the calamities that had befallen the people were a punishment from God. She called the flu pandemic isibeto, from the Xhosa word ukubeta, which means to hit. One of the prominent visions that she had during this dream was when she was shown how the brewing of alcohol was devastating the community through the effect that it had specifically on the young men. She was shown how women had moved from praying for the safety of young men who were dying in the gold mines to brewing beer, ukwala, for them. She was also shown a yellowish bag that was containing a brownish concoction called ubuti, which was used in the practice of witchcraft. The message detailed how there was an obsession among the people with witchcraft. In these visions that she had, she was commanded to preach to the chiefs and their counselors and to instruct them to work and rule the country according to their own ideas of nationhood. She was also shown a rotting Bible in the form of a dying tree that had been neglected. She was told that she wouldn't need a Bible because, besides the fact that she was illiterate, she was to be a catalyst for a new kind of civilization. Amongst other things, she was shown the last day of man, and she said that she looked up to the sky and saw the heavens shaking like the face of a cruel man. She became frightened and began to cry, when a voice said to her, "Don't cry, pray." When Nonteta regained consciousness, she thought she had been dreaming, only to find people hovering over her and holding her hands down and splashing her with water, and she wondered what was happening. And that's when she realized that she had died and returned to life. Nonteta's visions launched her as a prophetess. Some of the narratives that came from out of her dreams became the cornerstones of her prophetic message, and she established the Church of the Prophetess, possibly one of the first black female-led churches in the country. Since she was illiterate, Umam Nonteta is said to have read divine messages by looking at her hands. It was as though the scriptures were somehow inscribed onto the palms of her hand. She would then ask one of her congregants to read certain scriptures, which would somehow always echo what she had seen on her hand. Around 1922, the government knew about Umam Nonteta and her church, but they were not really fussed about it. In fact, they approved of her preaching against such vices and alcohol and adultery, because ultimately the colonial farmers needed a sober workforce, so her work worked for them. However, as her following grew, and it became known that her sermons were aimed at bridging the divide between Amaqoboka and Amaqaba, and that she was preaching black independence and self-reliance, it was then that her message was said to be anti-white. The farmers started spreading rumors that she was instructing her congregations to stop working on the white farms. The state knew that it had to act, and to act swiftly and effectively. But they had to be cautious about how they handled this situation, and the reason the authorities were so apprehensive about confronting her was because of a similar incident that had happened a year earlier, an event that was known as the Bull Hook Massacre. In 1921, a prophet named Enoch Mgijima had gathered in a Bull Hook subsection called Ntabelanga in the now Eastern Cape, along with his congregations of about 3,000, who were known as the Israelites. His basic message was that people needed to go back to the Old Testament teachings, which were also in line with much of the cultural customs of the Xhosa people, which he believed the people themselves had abandoned. He and his followers were to observe the Passover in that area, but it seems like they did not have official permission to stay for an extended period of time. The Israelites had essentially came for Passover and never left. Instead of leaving, they established a self-sustained community where the inhabitants did not need to work for white farmers for income. As more and more black farm workers left their surrounding farms to join the Israelites, the white farmers started accusing them of stock theft. Nkijima's reasons for not moving was that God had instructed him that it was in that land that he and his followers were to witness the end of the world and the coming of the Christ. For this reason, they would not move until God's word had been fulfilled. They had essentially recolonized the land. The government eventually decided that they would remove the Israelites from their promised land by force. Oh, the irony. Mgijima advised his followers that they could leave before the police came, but not a single person left. On May 24th, at about 10:30 a.m., the police and soldiers were in position around Ntabelanga, overlooking the Israelite village. About 500 Israelite men, armed with clubs and spears, were split into regiments to prepare for battle. It is not certain how the battle itself started. It may have begun after a shot was accidentally fired, resulting in the two sides clashing. The Israelites ran towards the police lines and were gunned down. After about 20 minutes, 200 Israelites were dead and almost 100 wounded. Enoch Mgijima was arrested without resistance, and the arresting officer, a Colonel Truta, says to Mgijima, "I hold you responsible for this bloodshed." To which Mgijima replies, "You take your orders from the government. I take mine from Jehovah." This incident became known as the Bull Hook Massacre. Because of how messy the situation became, the authorities needed to find a way to deal with Umam Nonteta that would not lead to unnecessary violence. Instead of forcefully confronting Umam Nonteta and her congregation, The authorities instead arrested Mamnon Teta and committed her to a mental asylum, first at Fort Beaufort Mental Hospital, and in 1924 transferred her to Weskopies in Pretoria. In 1935, Mamnon Teta Ngwengwe died in isolation in a mental institution. Her body was discarded in an unmarked pauper's grave. The title of this episode is Spirituality in a World Falling Apart. If the statement was to be turned into a question, like, how do you navigate spirituality in a world falling apart? It would be invitingly easy to get philosophical about the answer. If someone were to ask you that question, it honestly wouldn't be all that difficult to put together a decently meaningful answer. And the reason it would be so relatively easy to answer this question right now is because of a hopeful naivety based on the sense that we don't really know what's going to happen, and a frightened part of us is hoping that things won't turn out that bad. The reason that I started off with Nonqawuse and Nontetha Nkwenkwe's story is because I wanted to demonstrate that we actually have been here before. A people dealing with the ravages of a pandemic. Nonqawuse's era had the lung disease, and Umam Nontetha had the Spanish flu, and we had COVID. A people witnessing the gradual loss of their land and their sense of identity. Nonqawuse lived to see the machinery of the colonial system swallow her people whole. And Mamnon Teta's prophetic mission was birthed in the midst of the labor migration that saw the black family disintegrate. We have capitalism that is eating away not just at land and resources, but at the very idea of being human, and has placed our value on how much money we can make for a company. And a people finding themselves being ripped into conflicting groups based on socioeconomic views. Nonqawuse's era had Amathamba and Amakokoja. Mamnon Teta had Amaqoboka and Amaqaba. And what do we have? We have the so-called black middle class and the hood. And we also have a subtler war that is beginning to take shape and will soon be in full swing. And this one is a war that we started. It is a war between two groups called black women and black men. Then there's alcohol. I think it's just astonishingly profound how long alcohol has been an issue in black society. If you look back at Ubabo Fuze's accounts that date back to the 1800s, it seems like it has been 100 years. More than 100 years, it has been centuries. One of the main components of this story that I want to highlight is the issue of how media can distort a people's sense of themselves and their spirituality. In all the three cases that I've mentioned, there was an aspect of how media distorted a people's story. In Nonqawuse's case, it was a distortion after the fact. It was in how the story was put into the history books. And in the case of Mamnon Teta and Utad Nkijima, it was a distortion during the time, during the fact. And today, to a very large extent, the reason that you feel so confused and have such a deep sense of feeling like you're lost is because of how media is distorting our understanding of our beliefs in relation to us and our culture specifically. On the one hand, this distortion has bred a sense of confusion, and on the other hand, it has also created a perpetual conflict between people. Every single day, people are fighting over their spiritual views. And I think what is more tragic is that we have entire channels dedicating to highlighting the most horrible aspects of our beliefs. We have entire channels owned by black people that are perpetuating the conflict and the misinformation. And one can only wonder, how is it that the coming generations are going to be able to discern what was true and what was not, what was misleading and what was
information if they were to just look at the media that they were consuming, and not just on TV, but on social media as well, where we are a big part of what the problem actually is. If Ununqawuse was to ask you how to navigate spirituality in a world falling apart, how would you answer her? If you were to sit with that little teenage girl in that place that was her jail cell, essentially, if you were to sit with her in that moment and just look at her in her eye, knowing what was going to happen to her, and she asked you, how do you navigate spirituality in a world falling apart? What would you say? If Umam Nontetha Nkwenkwe asked you, how do you navigate spirituality in a world falling apart? How would you answer her? If you sat with her in whatever ward she was in the mental asylum, the one that they put her in for trying to lead her people to a better life, and she looked at you right in the eye and she asked you, how do you navigate spirituality in a world falling apart? What would you say? If Enoch Mkijima asked you, how do you navigate spirituality in a world falling apart? What would you say if you were to lock eyes with him across a battlefield in Bulhoek as he watched the brutality of the colonial system descend on his followers, knowing that many of them would die on that day? And he asked you, how do you navigate spirituality in a world falling apart? What would you say to him? There's a term that I came across. It's called millenarianism. It's a phenomenon that is birthed within the collective psyche of a people who have been oppressed historically, and it manifests as some kind of prophecy that tells the people that an imminent and dramatic change is coming, and that change will end their suffering. The custodians of such a prophecy would then instruct their people as to what changes in their lives they must make in order to hasten the change or to prepare for it. This process of preparing for the coming change usually becomes a movement, or it becomes a philosophy, or it becomes a church. There are countless cases of such movements across nearly all indigenous people across the world, many of whom came up when the people started feeling the brutal effects of the colonial system. Some say the age-old prophecy of the Messiah was the origin of millenarianism, when the Jewish people had long lived under the brutal regime of the Romans. The fact that millenarianism occurs so consistently under specific circumstances does give a sense that when people have been oppressed for a long time, the idea of a dramatic change, it's more of a physiological response than a spiritual one. Maybe the sheer force of their collective psyche and their collective grief and suffering gives birth to the idea of a change needing to happen so that they can be saved. But for me, this idea leaves a bitter taste in my mouth, because it implies that an oppressed people need to be worthy of being saved. It is not enough that they have been suffering, but they still need to do more in order to earn whatever God they subscribe to and His grace and protection. Perhaps the biggest difference between us and the eras of Ununqawuse and Umam Nontetha is that we don't have a millenarian movement. We don't have a prophecy about an imminent change, or the idea that something, someone is coming to save us. What we do have, however, are public figures who hold our collective attention with their commanding and often controversial views on spirituality. They have TV shows, they have YouTube channels, they have an enormous social media following filled with diehard fans who are willing to defend their spiritual leaders to their death, at least online. But when you filter through the trending topics, the Twitter beefs, and the TikTok initiations, you find a people in desperate need of spiritual belonging. This desperation stems from the fact that we know that there's very little that the system that we live in cannot take away from us. It is a desperation to have something to hold on to. Having gone through these histories of our people from the 1800s, what becomes clear is that the world is not falling apart. Instead, the world is changing. The world has been changing, and the world will not stop changing. What is hard for us as Africans or as indigenous people is that every time the world changes, it takes away a piece of us with it. Sometimes it takes an entire chunk, an entire continent, or an entire generation. Sometimes it takes an entire people. This makes it hard for us to pinpoint where exactly we are on the timeline of history or which phase we are in. Like, are we yet another generation headed towards more hardship in a never-ending cycle of oppression and exploitation? Or are we the miracle generation that will change everything? Are we truly our ancestors' wildest dreams, or are we just a dream deferred, drying and festering, waiting to explode? I think it would be facetious to imagine that we are either doomed or miraculous, but only history will decide that. Ultimately, what we are trying to do is not to navigate spirituality in a world falling apart, but rather trying to find our own spiritual anchor in the midst of the changes. I want to emphasize the idea of an anchor because it helps with thinking about being rooted yet being flexible. I started the episode by speaking about Ubabfuze's book and his view on life in the late 1800s. Looking back at it now, it is easy to see what things he was wrong about. His understanding of the world was limited. Likewise, today, we feel as though our understanding of life and the world is finite. We believe that we know all there is to know about us as a people and how the world works, and we can't even begin to imagine what it is that in years to come, we will come to realize that we're absolutely wrong about. An anchor allows a boat to be in sync with the waves without being carried away by them. We tend to imagine that our approach to the connection between ourselves and all aspects of life should be that of a tree and its roots deep into the ground, unmoving. There's a way in which our cultural socialization also implies a certain nobility in being rooted in one place and in one view and in one perspective and in one understanding of things. But the time that we are living in is showing us in a very, very vivid way that there does come a moment when an anchor has to be unhooked for a boat to chart a new course and find a new way of being. The reason that I spoke about the histories of Unongqawuse and Umamnonteta is because deep down, these are the scenarios that we are actually afraid of. It scares us that in whatever belief that we may hold, be it about God or ancestors or marriage or relationships or whatever, we could be holding on to a belief that will ultimately lead to a horrifying end. That we could lead ourselves down a path where we die a lonely death in a place that no one will ever find us in. Or that we could lead others astray and bring harm to the people that we say we care about. Finding what that anchor is lies in how you answer this question. Spiritually, what do you believe about yourself? Personally, I believe that we come into different lifetimes in order to deal with aspects of life that are important to the growth of our souls. I believe that the very thing that you're struggling with in this life is the very thing that you came into this life to deal with. I believe that you and me have a deep-seated fear of living in a world that is seemingly falling apart, and that is precisely why we chose to be in this life at this very moment. I believe that we are here to learn how to embrace and overcome this fear. What I don't know is, what will this do? I don't know what this will solve, and I don't know what it will change. But this is what in my heart is true. I am anchored in knowing that the ocean of spirituality is vast, and my understanding will always have waves to ride and different storms to endure. My understanding of my ancestors and the different ways in which we practice our beliefs will ebb and flow as the waves come and go. And for as long as my anchor is firm, I believe that there's no wave that will carry me off into dangerous waters. I am anchored in knowing that this human life is only one aspect of an unimaginably expansive spiritual existence, and the pain and fear that this body feels ultimately does not change this reality. In the end, my anchor, the thing that my boat is hooked onto, is God. And should there ever come a time when I have to unhook my anchor and chart a different course and try to find a different way of being, I will be comforted in knowing that the entire ocean itself is God. I would like to thank Unongqawuse and Umamnontetha and Utata Mgijima and Ubabufuze for availing these stories to me. I'd like to thank the spirits of all those whose names we will never know, who have been swallowed by history and swallowed by misinformation and distortion, and all those people whose stories we will never really know. We are in a difficult time, and they went through a difficult time. But nonetheless, it is a time, and we are the custodians of this time. And whatever that we do is going to go down in our history. I was caught by a scene in a movie. I think it was one of the Black Panther stories or a scene with Black Panther. And then there's a scene where he's talking to General Okoye and he says, "This is not a place to die." The time we're in is not a place to die. And I don't mean a physical death. I mean a spiritual death. I mean a mental death. This is not a place to die. We mustn't let our troubles and our circumstances and our media and technology to turn our spirituality and our lives into a graveyard. This is not a place to die. The issue we have is a fear to live. This is not a place to die. We can't die here. My name is Vusumzi Nqande. Thank you for joining me on yet another episode of The Journey Kwantu. I wish you light, I wish you courage, and I wish you all the very best on your journey. Makwande.